The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. And today I'm really excited to have my dear friend, Patrick Bronco, on the show. And Patrick has a very unique story. He was with the Foreign Service. He did a lot of really amazing tours, Venezuela, Pakistan, Colombia. He worked in DC. He worked in ops. And then he decided to pursue a political career. And so in keeping with a series of interviewing people who have left the Foreign Service, we've invited Patrick to talk about what's it like to leave the Foreign Service and what's it like to pursue a political career. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you, Tanya. Excited to be here.
I'm excited as well. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, you left the Foreign Service in 2020, actually January 2020, right before COVID hit, right? And then you were campaigning, like, and before we even get to there, like, what was it that made you take the leap from leaving the Foreign Service? Because it's a really big decision for a lot of people, right? I mean, the Foreign Service, a lot of people study, they do pursue graduate degrees, they invest a lot of time through internships, you were a Wrangell Fellow, right? And then you get in and it's this amazing job, and then you decide to completely switch career paths. Talk to us a little bit about that transition.
Yeah, it was a unique transition. I didn't make that decision lightly. And, you know, we have the same financial advisor. And when I told him that I was leaving the Foreign Service, he's like, do you know how much you're giving up in your potential pension to leave the Foreign Service? But, you know, for me, what was really the motivator was I'm part Native Hawaiian. And, you know, we don't have many Native Hawaiians who run for office. And I felt very fortunate that from the Foreign Service that I had such great experiences, but I wanted to do something more local, do something more directly impacting my community as well as directly impacting my people. And so that was the big motivator to come back home. The other thing as well is, you know, I got the Wrangell Fellow when I was fellowship when I was 23 years old. You know, I entered the Foreign Service when I was 25 and I was in for 8 years. You know, I felt like I kind of grew up in the Foreign Service and I kind of only knew the Foreign Service. And so I wanted to see what it was like on the outside, but also wanted to see, you know, pursue my dreams. You know, I always wanted to run for office. I knew that was in my future. And so it just made sense to try this. And so that's why I left the Foreign Service in January 2020 to come back home.
And, you know, I think I remember you and I having discussions prior to leaving because it was a big decision for you, right? I mean, you mentioned the financial advisor and talking about the pension and what that's worth. And we've discussed that on a couple of other shows. And so that was one consideration, right? Because, I mean, politics, at least initially, I don't think it pays all that well. Maybe the Foreign Service is a little better paid, it sounds like.
A lot better.
Yeah. So, like, you know, there's financial considerations. But then also, you know, you put in 8 years into this career, and it was a difficult decision because I think initially you considered going on leave without pay, right? Like, how did that work in terms of, you know, what did the department say? Did you get permission? Could you have done leave without pay to run for office?
So I wasn't able to do leave without pay. That was the option. But because I was actively seeking political office, I had to resign my commission from the department. It is a little vague on the rules, but technically I have 5 years from when I departed to go back. And what I understood when I spoke to my CDO when I did leave was that you had 5 years to go back, and it was only if there was a position open in your cone. I'm a public diplomacy officer. And then if there was an opening, which she said, you know, there's many O3 PD officer openings, also the department would choose your first tour and it would be a hardship tour.
Interesting. And at that point, I mean, then you did make that difficult decision. How did that feel after you resigned?
It felt great the first month. And then after not getting the paycheck anymore, it was like, you know, maybe this wasn't. And then also the difficulty of running for office in COVID, right? You know, running for office requires a lot of, you know, retail politics, face-to-face with constituents. It's knocking doors, sign waving here in Hawaii. It's a unique thing that we have. And with COVID, that wasn't possible. And so how do you navigate that? And there were times where I questioned it. I was like, you know, right now it's the middle of COVID. I can't knock doors. I'm trying to get my message out. And that secure job, that secure home, you know, that beautiful apartment that I was living in prior in Colombia, as well as that paycheck, did come to mind. And for me too, you know, Hawaii is very expensive. And so moving home also came with the decision. You know, I grew up in a large multi-generational household. You know, at one point there was 18 of us in one house.
Wow.
And, you know, I loved that. Growing up, I loved it, you know, that concept. And then being away for 12 years and kind of living on your own and then moving back into that family structure, you know, there was an adjustment period. Definitely for me to figure that out. And so that's, you know, something, if you are leaving the Foreign Service, kind of think about how do you adjust into your living situation post the Foreign Service as well. Because it is, you know, you don't have GSO to call when your toilet gets plugged or when there's something wrong with the house, right? It's a change. It's an adjustment.
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of benefits to working overseas and being at embassies, GSO being one of them, right? Mm-hmm. And so there were financial considerations and there were living considerations. But my question would be, and I don't know if I would ever run for office because it's just not my personality type, but how do you start? I mean, you've been away for 8 years. People don't know who you are and you're doing this grassroots campaign. How does one start a political campaign or how does one run for office when you just, you know, you've been doing something else? You've been like halfway around the world for the last 8 years.
So for me, what I started doing was I connected back with kind of the networks that I knew that I was a part of, right? I'm Native Hawaiian, so connecting with Native Hawaiian leaders. Also, I went to the Kamehameha Schools, which is, you know, a very old established school here in Hawaii. So connecting back with alumni or my classmates. But what I started doing when I moved home, I just started knocking doors. And so I knocked about almost 4,000 doors before the pandemic.
That is a lot of doors. That must be exhausting. How like so did you just get up in the morning and that's all you would do? You would just walk and like knock doors and talk to neighborhoods?
Yep. I would just knock doors and just like you knock and say, "Aloha, this is Pat Bronco. You know, I'm running for office. How are you? Or is there anything that we can improve in our neighborhood?" And so I was just doing that, going door to door every day. And it was exhausting, right? Because, you know, it's a very unnatural thing. One, most people, you know, they're busy with their lives. They don't want to be interrupted by someone. And number
two, you're trying to sell them something or, yeah.
Exactly, right? And so here, one of the tricks is here in Hawaii, when you knock doors, if you're a politician, we wear a lei, right? So people don't think you're a Mormon trying to solicit at the door.
Everyone's peddling something, whether it's religion or something to purchase. Yeah.
And, you know, people are skeptical as well if a politician's coming to the door. And usually when they talk to you, it's not friendly, right? It's usually, you know, an issue.
They're mad about something.
Right? And so you have to do that. And my neighborhood is, or my district is a purple district. You know, it was represented by a Republican for 30 years. And so, you know, there's people on both sides. I'm a Democrat as well. And also during this age, right? This was when, you know, in the middle of Trump's presidency. And so there's also hyper partisanship and having to navigate that. I think that's where my diplomatic skills came in. And I think the number one diplomatic skill is one is composure. And number two is being a good listener.
Yeah, composure under fire. Still remember that class. And that's actually a really interesting angle. You know, what did the Foreign Service teach you that you could take away to do in different careers? Because, you know, sometimes I talk to Foreign Service officers and they say things like, "Well, I don't know what my skill set is." And I feel like that is a reflection, not of their skill set, but of the fact that maybe sometimes the things that Foreign Service officers do don't actually translate well into corporate speak or, you know, the job sector. Cause, you know, we talk in acronyms, there's, you know, all of these different things and government is a little bit different. It's a different world, right? So what did you find like in terms of that skill set that you developed? You talked about, you know, composure. What other skills kind of translated well into a new field?
Being a strong writer. That was so during COVID, our governor would come out with these emergency proclamations about every week or so, and no one understood what they meant or what was allowed. Like, for example, here in Hawaii, you could walk through the park to get to the beach. You could swim in the water, but you couldn't sit on the beach, right? And there was these weird rules that people didn't really understand or know. So what I would do is every time the emergency proclamation came out, I would read through them and then I would like simplify them. And I think this came from being an ops, right? I made like an ops brief of like, this is what you need to know of the current situation. And we would send these emails out. I had an email distro. I had about 5,000 emails in the community, and I would send it out. And that was kind of like how people got to know me, was about this, right? They knew that, you know, I could take information, I could write succinctly, and I could help answer the questions they needed. And so that really kind of set me apart from my opponents. And now currently in office, we're the only office that actually sends a weekly newsletter. And again, it's very much like, here's the information you need to know, right? Not like very political, very fluffy or whatnot, very to the point. And again, it's my way of just continuing the ops brief here in Hawaii.
Well, how funny. Who would have thought, right, that like your time on the seventh floor there would translate well into deciphering government messaging to the public in Hawaii. But hey, you know, there's a lot of skills that translate from the Foreign Service over to different parts. I'm still impressed, honestly, that you had the physical stamina to go and knock on all of these thousands of doors and, you know, talk to all of these people. When you were speaking to people, did you tell them that you were in the Foreign Service? Did they know what a Foreign Service officer was? Did it matter? Or was it more focused on kind of the things that they, you know, were interested in or upset about? And how did those conversations go? It sounds like you had a lot of them. And during COVID too. So like, I'm thinking, here you are in someone's doorway with a lay, but you also have a mask on and they're like, who's this guy on my doorstep?
Yeah, so that was one of the things. When COVID first hit, I couldn't knock doors for like 4 or 5 months, right? Mm. So another way, like for crisis management skills, like that's the thing for us, right? We know how to respond. We're very calm as Foreign Service officers. So what my family did, I'll tell a little sidebar story. We realized that our elder population, we use the word kupuna here in Hawaii, which translates as ancestors. We know they needed help. So what we did was we made kupuna kits, which was basically a can of soup, applesauce, tea, gloves, sanitizer in Ziploc bags. And we put it out on Facebook, you know, kind of going back to my PD skills. And like, we put out this, like, if anyone needs this supplies, you know, we'll go there. And we got like 60,000 views on this one video. And within like 2 days, and we delivered over 500 out into the community. And then after that, we realized no one had masks. So what we did was we set up these long tables in my garage. And this is where like there was kind of runs on elastic for masks. Mm-hmm. So I would go down to the local fabric store. I would wait in line for about an hour and I would get my 5 yards of elastic. And then I would come home and I would cut fabric. My aunts would pin and then my grandmother would sew them. But we made almost 4,000 masks.
Wow. For
community, and we gave it out for free. And so it was a way for me to show the community what I was about, right? When there's issues, you know, I'm going to snap into action to do something about it. And that was really important. The other thing too, when I was in office as well, you know, during the second wave of COVID, many people needed to get vaccinated. And so what we did, I went to the governor and I said, hey, you know, people, because there's people who are not comfortable. We were doing these max vaccination sites where like it was like you had to wait 4 or 5 hours. Mm. And it just didn't make sense. So I suggested that we, you know, decentralize. And at this time, all the libraries were closed here in Hawaii. So I advocated that we should set up vaccination and testing sites at all the local libraries in Hawaii. There was 26 of them, I think. And one, it's a safe place. It's a place that people know and it's in the community. The governor didn't like that idea. And so I was like, well, I'm going to do something. And so I called the Department of Health here in Hawaii and I said, I want a vaccination pop-up in our farmer's market. We have a farmer's market every Thursday from 4 to 7. And they told me that my community was not a priority. And that was, to me, unacceptable. Absolutely. Ouch. Unacceptable. And so what I did was I reached out to a nonprofit that I had worked with doing some work helping the homeless, and they had nurses, and they said, we'll give you a nurse and we'll bring the vaccines and the testing kits if you get the site. And so I called our local farmers market, and then I asked my grandma if I could borrow her tents and her luau tables and her chairs, and we set up in the farmers market 3 months for 3 months every Thursday from 4 to 7, and you know, we vaccinated hundreds of people, and we did over thousands of tests. And wow. People could just come in to the farmer's market within 15 minutes, get it, and then we would email them the result. And so I think that's where my value add and where the Foreign Service taught me is, how do you respond? How do you solve an issue? Right? I remember my first boss told me in the Foreign Service, hey, if you mess up or there's a problem, don't come and just tell me about the problem. Tell me how you're going to fix it and how you're going to solve it. And I feel like that's something we really emphasize in the Foreign Service. And so definitely use those skills, those professional skills that I learned in the Foreign Service to help out my community.
Amazing. So what I did not mention when I introduced you is actually you are Hawaii's state representative for District 50. So you actually won the election and are working in, you know, the state of Hawaii as a representative. So tell us about campaigning. So you're out there, you're knocking on doors. You know, did you get a campaign team? Did you have to get donations? Like, it's very grassroots, right? So how does that all work? And then the election, what was that like?
Yeah, so it's campaigning, knocking on doors, but you need to get a volunteer base. Luckily, I have a large family, so I leaned heavily on them. But as you start knocking doors and so you start meeting people, your message resonates and people like that. And they start building. And, you know, the sad part of politics is a lot of money is involved. Mm-hmm. And you have to, you know, fundraise. One of the part is fundraising. And, you know, Tanya, you were a recipient of one of my calls. Is you start off with your friends and family and you just call them and be like, hey, you know, I'm running for office. Would appreciate a donation. It's called call time. Mm-hmm. And you start there. So I recommend if you are interested in running for office, make sure you keep a good database of all your friends' addresses, phone numbers, emails. So when you need to raise money, you can quickly call them for donations.
And that's, you know, it's not the most comfortable thing, right? Like, but you know, I think probably what you found is that people showed up for you. Cause I mean, clearly you were very successful and you won the election. So talk to me about how that went down in terms of the actual election day. Cause you know, you were running for a seat that had been occupied for, you were mentioning someone from the Republican Party for quite a long time, right? And you were this new young upstart and you got it. So talk to us about how the election went.
Yeah. And also, I didn't realize this at the time until after I won, but people are like, you know, we thought you were going to lose. You're the political outsider. Because in the Democratic primary, I was running against a teacher who had ran before and won. And I didn't realize, like, how everyone said it was an uphill battle, but maybe I'm just a little naive or Pollyanna-ish and just was like, I'm going to just work hard and this is going to...
And it worked. It worked.
So that's kind of the election night. Primary was close. I won by 500 votes. I actually think what helped me was actually Republicans who actually voted for me in the Democratic primary. Who
switched. Interesting. And why? Curious.
They saw that I had an appeal, because when I was running for office, you know, my messaging wasn't like good Democrats, bad Republicans. It was more continued strong leadership. The previous representative, served our community for 30 years and she was great and she did a lot and she was a Republican, but
she cared about the community.
She cared about the community. She was a Eisenhower Republican, that's what she calls herself. She was big on civil unions. She never backed down. She fought for gay rights, gay marriage. She's pro-choice as well, so she fought really hard for these issues. And so that's why my messaging was, you know, we've had a great leader. We just need another great leader for our community to continue on. And that was the strong message. So we get through the Democratic primary, and then we go on to into the general. And my Republican opponent was, you know, throwing attacks at me, saying certain things like, oh, you haven't been home or blah, 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 blah. But actually, out of all the candidates, I had lived in my town the longest, actually. And I think it also helped that, you know, I'm fourth generation from my town. My family moved to my town in 1953. And so we've been there for a very long time. We're not a political family. We're never interested in politics type of thing. But I think that helped. I think the homeboy story kind of just really worked. And they saw that, you know, I was willing to work hard and, you know, I gave up a lot and they saw my heart for service. And so we won in the general and we started the next day. It was kind of crazy. The next day driving into the state capitol and being like having the orientation, literally the next day you go into work. And it's a little surreal. It is a little surreal. And, you know, me as a little boy, I'll share with you what started me with my interest in politics. When I was in kindergarten, my kindergarten teacher's cousin was the governor of Hawaii. So we went on a field trip to the governor's mansion and there was in the back, the governor's mansion is the former private residence of Hawaii's last queen, Kuilaliokalani. And we were in her bedroom and my grandmother was on the field trip and she misstepped and she fell onto the queen's bed. And the docent, you know, by accident, and the docent like snapped at her and was like, "How dare you touch the bed?" And in my head, I was like, no, I didn't say anything, but I was like, you know what? No one talks to my grandmother like this. I'm going to become the governor one day so my grandmother can sleep in this bed.
Oh, goodness. Funny story.
And so that's what kind of like made politics, like I realized politics in my head, but also it kind of started that, you know, as a young boy, I had a strong sense of justice. And so that's one of the things that I ran on and things we've passed. You know, the first bill I passed was the prohibition of ghost guns here in Hawaii. There was a loophole in the law. Our police officers were confiscating these, you know, unmarked, unregistered guns. But because of the loophole in the law, they weren't able to prosecute the cases. And so we closed the loophole. That was the first bill that I passed within 6 months. The next bill that I worked on was the reestablishment of the Youth Conservation Corps. So it was 1,000 temporary jobs for our youth to get into the green economy. And so we started that. The other bill that I'm known for is also in Hawaii, we have a sad history that the state effectively prohibited the speaking of our native language, Olelo Hawaii, the Hawaiian language, in public. And so my great-grandfather, who was a pure Hawaiian man, would go to school and he would get beaten for speaking Hawaiian in public schools. And so he was taught to speak English. And then he would go home, speak English in a Hawaiian-speaking household and get beaten for speaking English in the Hawaiian. My grandfather didn't know better, but this is a very, not an uncommon story that happens with many of our native families here in Hawaii. Many people have this story. And so the resolution, the state effectively apologized. It was also important that I wrote the bill in our native language as well. The idea actually stemmed from my time in Colombia during the peace process and how they started these truth-telling commissions to start kind of a cathartic process for stories of trauma to come out. And I felt here in Hawaii, we have a very, you know, turbulent and sad history, and this process needed to happen, a truth-telling. And so this was the idea behind the resolution to start this kind of commission, this truth-telling process for our own history here in Hawaii.
Fascinating. I would have never made that link, but, you know, I think that is the beauty of the Foreign Service and even of an international life in general, right? Because you can go around and see things that work in different places and apply them in different contexts for similar purposes, right? And for the greater good, if you will. And I think, you know, and this is just from my vantage point, I think my thought is that people saw in you somebody who was willing to stand up for the community and work for the community and wasn't interested in being somebody partisan, for example. So you talked about the masks, you talked about the kapuna kits, and, you know, even the things about the governor's declarations that you're sending that out for everybody and, you know, deciphering it and saying, here's what the government is saying, here's what it's not saying, right? And so all of this is a public service. It doesn't necessarily say this is my agenda or this is not, right? But at the same time, politics is a pretty cutthroat field, right? It is not diplomacy where people are polite. How has that transition been? Because, you know, in the Foreign Service, like, a lot of times we'll be in meetings and people are all politely talking about an issue and nobody's critical and nobody says anything. You're kind of like, well, did we all just agree? I'm not quite sure, you know, but politics is a whole nother thing. How was that transition of like the not so polite side of things?
Yeah, it's been a transition. You know, I'm more of a natural diplomat. I want to engage. I want to figure out issues.
Consensus, yes.
Yeah, I'm a consensus builder, right? And that's my leadership style. But when you have 51 people in the state house who, you know, all have been elected on a mandate, it gets very different. But what I've always tried to make sure is, one, to show professionalism. So, for example, if I'm voting no or with reservations on a colleague's bill, I will go and tell them beforehand to make sure they're not blindsided. Also, I think people find that I'm very open to dialogue. If there's an issue, I reach out to both sides, the activists on both sides of the issue, to understand. That has not always been the reciprocated behavior that I've, you know, received, but I try to model what I would like. And when it comes to issues, I stand up and I talk about the issues, and I think people can tell that I speak from the heart. I'm very sincere when it comes to the issues, and you know, there's things that I'm very passionate about. Another issue that I've been advocating here in Hawaii, and it came from the Foreign Service actually, was child marriage is not illegal in most states. Here in Hawaii, you can get married at 15 with parental and court consent, and at 16 with just parental consent. So when I was in Pakistan and I was on the visa line, we would have young women who would come and apply for fiancé visas, and they were 14, 15, 16, etc. And we would look at whatever the state statute was. And if it was legal for them to go, then we would have to approve the visa. And I remember we would take to a separate room and interview them privately, and we would ask, do you really want to go to the United States? Most of them wanted to, some of them didn't want to go. And so, you know, we would deny the visa, and they could blame it on the bad American. And, you know, one of the laws that I introduced in Hawaii was to abolish child marriage, because I remember that experience being on the visa line in Pakistan, and these young women, some of them being forced into marriages that they didn't want to be in. And so that's another issue that came from the Foreign Service that I advocated for here in Hawaii.
Who would have thought it would have had such an impact, right? And then, so you're in office, this is November 2020, you've won the election, you're, you know, as time goes on, you know, COVID is sort of kind of, I guess, getting in the rearview mirror at this point. And people start talking about you running for Congress. How did that happen?
Yeah, our congressman after one term decided that DC wasn't for him. And so I started being asked to consider, you know, I know DC well, I did spend some time on the Hill. And the unique thing here in Hawaii is most people run on term limits, but in Hawaii, because we're such a small delegation, we look for people who are going to stay for the long term. And, you know, the great example is Senator Daniel Inouye. He was in Congress for 55 years. And so Hawaii knows that to get seniority, to get that type of people staying, to get the resources, we need someone who's willing to stay. And so, you know, I'm single, I'm not married, I don't have any kids. I know the DC travel because, you know, I did it all around the world. And so I was considered. And so in June of 2022, when our congressman announced that he was not seeking re-election, I threw my hat in and I was running for Congress, which was another crazy adventure. But I'm proud of myself that I put myself out there. I do believe elections should be elections and they shouldn't be coronations. And so we gave the voters another option out there. I was not successful in my bid for Congress. I do have to give up my current state house seat to run, but I'm proud that I put myself out there. You know, Tanya, you may have known this, but you know, I'm 35 years old. I'm the son of a teenage mom and a dad who didn't finish high school. I grew up on welfare, and my biography statistically shouldn't say former U.S. diplomat, current state representative, and now a candidate for Congress. And even though we weren't successful, I still feel very proud of what we were able to create and do and what's next for me. I don't know. I just joined the Navy Reserves as an intelligence officer, which is exciting, another facet. But I'm excited for the future. And I was talking to you prior a little bit about this, but I kind of feel like Now it's my next tour. That's how I kind of view it in the mindset of the Foreign Service and what's next. And so I'm in the bidding process to see what's going to happen.
I think that's amazing. I mean, given your history, and like you said, the statistics are all stacked against you, and to see what you've achieved, you know, not just through your fellowships, but in the Foreign Service and beyond. I mean, I'm excited to see where you go next. I think the world is your oyster. And sometimes I forget that you're 35, to be very honest. Not that we talk about age a lot, but I mean, that is a lot of living in a short amount of time, right? And you've traveled all over the world, and you know, the Foreign Service was a step, and your political career is a step, and it's very, I just can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. I can't wait to see what I do next too.
So do you have another run for Congress in mind, or are you thinking, you know, what's next? At least, are you going to continue with the political career, or?
I don't know. I do think I have a lot of unfinished work. You know, I do have a heart for service, but I'm not one of those politicians that are fearful of being out of office. Mm-hmm. I think there's still work you can do outside or in office. And so we'll see what happens in the future. I'm not putting it out. I can still return to the Foreign Service, actually. So options are out there, and I'm excited to see what's next for me. And to kind of dream, and to, we've talked about this, Tanya, is like, you try on, you're trying on the different clothes, right? It's like trying on clothes, the different options, like when you're bidding for different posts, right? Oh, I'm going to try on Istanbul. I don't know, maybe Istanbul. I'm going to try on Bogota. And that's how I feel right now in my profession. You know, I'm going to try on maybe running for the future, or I'm going to, right now, I bought the clothes, a uniform into the Navy Reserves. So I'm excited to see. I've even thought about maybe going back to school. Tanya, you inspired me too to get my real estate license. So I did all the classes for real estate about a year ago as well. So we'll see what happens. But I'm excited for the future. And I think, you know, as people are listening, it's all right to take the leap if you don't know all the options. But just think through, right? Always have plan B, C, or D. But follow your passions. Take the leap. Do it.
Amazing. Well, there you have it, people. Representative Patrick Branco, a true generalist in every sense of the word. Patrick, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.